Thank you, Alain, for bringing me to this temple of French science. It's a real pleasure to be in this exciting venue. I'm going to basically come back to the dente gyrus, and what I'm going to try to do is sort of show you functions of neurogenesis within the dente gyrus, both in the mood and in the cognitive domain. So we're going to start sort of the first half of the presentation focusing more on the sort of classic function of the hippocampus, which is the cognitive function, the one that relates to learning and memory. And then in the second half, we'll deal with the less understood function of the hippocampus, the one that deals with anxiety and emotions. So a brief introduction just to cover some of the aspects of hippocampal neurogenesis that we have not covered sort of in the other presentations earlier in the meeting. One is a theme that you have already now heard multiple times, which is that we have a phenomenon that is conserved throughout species, and we heard yesterday of fish and birds. In mammals, there are, however, very interesting differences, sort of, and I think these differences are worth exemplifying because I think they give us maybe the beginning of an understanding of why neurogenesis is taking place only in some areas. And as you know, you have now heard many times about the subventricular zone giving rise to neurons that primarily go in rodents to the olfactory bulb, and the dente gyrus, where the neurons, in contrast, stay within the dente gyrus. And here we have an interesting difference sort of in mammalian evolution, which is that while in rodents the two phenomena are very prominent, when you move to primates, particularly human, olfactory bulb neurogenesis become vestigial and disappears roughly at about a year of age. So we have here something that I think illustrates already maybe a potential function of neurogenesis, which is to deal basically with the type of sensory information that the animal receives. As you know, rodents are much more dependent on their sense of smell to evaluate their environment than primates, who are much more visual. So that's one of the ideas for why in primates olfactory bulb neurogenesis and its related function in the smell world becomes less important. So a few numbers. This is just a blow-up of the dente gyrus, which is the part of the hippocampus where neurogenesis takes place. You have a layer of stem cells lining the hilus, and these stem cells give rise to young neurons. Here we have a marker for the young neurons. It's actually tau EGFP that's been knocked in the Pomp C locus for a reason that's not completely understood. That locus in this particular transgenic mice labels young neurons in a similar way as double cortin would, so neurons that are between a couple days of age until about a month of age. And you can see their dendrites extending into the molecular layer, as well as their axons extending to CA3. So just a few points about the numbers. In a mouse or a rat, there are, in an adult mouse or rat, there are about 3,000 new cells that are generated every day from that pool of stem cells. About 80% die within a month. And among the surviving ones, most of them, about 70%, become neurons. The other ones become glial cells or more stem cells. But what's most interesting, and that also is worth emphasizing because it relates probably to the function of neurogenesis in the hippocampus, is that all these steps are exquisitely sensitive to environmental conditions. When you're in an enriched situation, you have more proliferation, you have less cell death, and you have up to about almost 80% now of the cells that survive, and you have more of the differentiation toward the neuronal pathway. Up to about 90% now become neurons. In contrast, when you're in a stressful, impoverished environment, you have less proliferation, less survival, and less of the neuronal pathway. So I think that's also something which kind of starts to hint at the idea that neurogenesis may be a form of adaptation to different environments. And that's a theme you already heard a bit in Fiona's talk yesterday, where neurogenesis in the olfactory bulb seems to be also modulated by environmental conditions such as levels of foods that are available. So that's a theme that we'll maybe, if we have time at the end, come back to. So just to give you a bit of a visual sense for the dynamic range that we have between a stressful situation and an enriched situation. These are, in that case, it's a double quantine labeling, very similar to the PALM-C-Tau EGFP labeling I showed you earlier, that basically labels the neurons, again, between about 2 days of age until about a month of age. And by just counting the number of these double quantine positive cells, you can realize that there are about 100 times more in an enriched situation than in a stressful situation. In that case, the stressful situation is simply generated by isolating the mice for a month alone in their cage. This is the standard housing condition, and this is the enriched condition where they have larger cages, running wheels, toys to play with, tunnels to hide in, and so on. So we have a big dynamic range, again, probably in relation to some form of adaptation to the types of sensory modalities that are much more complex to handle when you're in an enriched situation than when you are in an impoverished one. A few points about the differentiations of these cells. So that's a cartoon that you have already seen now a few times in different shapes. The only point I want to make is that there is now accumulating evidence, primarily from electrophysiological studies, but somewhat also from behavioral studies, that as the stem cell mature into differentiated neurons, the young neurons underlie a critical window in which their properties are different from those of mature granule cells. And that window is roughly between 4 and 6 weeks. There's a bit of a debate for when it starts. Some people argue it starts a little earlier, like around 3 weeks. But what's clear is that there is a window where the neurons are more excitable, it's easier to induce LTP, and there is also evidence from behavioral studies that this is the critical period during which they have a unique contribution to behavior. And we'll come back to that point. So the way you want to think about neurogenesis is as having a variable size pool of these excitable cells that populate the circuit and influence that circuit in ways that we are going to get into. So in terms of the questions I'm going to ask, one is really one for which we really have little answer. Why is it only happening in the hippocampus? Now, there is also evidence that in human it's happening in the striatum. Why is it only restricted to these areas? That's something that we, if we have time, can come back at the very end. But there is, by and large, not really a good answer to that question. Another question I'm going to touch upon sort of is how can it impact cognition and mood? And for that, I'm going to at least provide you with a framework, showing that on the dorsal side, it's more likely to be involved in cognition, and on the ventral side of the dentate gyrus, it's more likely to be involved in mood. So there is dorsoventral segregation, a bit like the one you heard about in the lateral wall of the ventricle. So to understand what neurogenesis does in the dentate gyrus, the first thing you need to know is understand what the dentate gyrus does within the hippocampus. So this is the classic trisynaptic circuit of the hippocampus. Sensory information comes in from the entorhinal cortex, hits a first station, which is the dentate gyrus, a second station, which is CA3, then CA1, and then back to the entorhinal cortex. And it is that loop that is believed to enable us to encode memories and store at least for a while memories. And I say at least for a while because eventually these memories that are initially stored in CA3 probably migrate to for long-term storage to other cortical structures. So even though we are dealing here with a structure that is compact, we have very different computational functions that are performed in the three stations of the hippocampus. And there is increasing evidence from electrophysiological studies, I'll show you some of that, as well as from computational studies and even behavioral studies, that the dentate gyrus is involved in a process called pattern separation, while CA3 is involved in, if you want, the opposite process, which is pattern completion. And I'll give you a few examples of pattern separation and pattern completion. So the most seminal work probably pointing to the role of the dentate gyrus in pattern separation is actually electrophysiological work from the Mosers, who actually got the Nobel Prize, probably by and large for that work on the dentate gyrus and CA3. And what the Mosers did in a seminal paper, Lloyd Gebb et al. In 2007, was analyze place cell activity in various stations of the hippocampus. In that paper, they compared CA3 and the dentate gyrus as the animal moves into variable environments. And the way they did it is by morphing very progressively the square box into a circular box. So that allowed them to do very subtle transitions in the shape of the environment and analyze the evolution of the place cell behavior as the animal shifts very progressively from one box to a very similar box. And place cells are these very interesting cells that populate the whole hippocampus, not just the dentate gyrus. In that case, we're looking at CA3. You find them also in the dentate gyrus or in CA1, which are basically stochastically recruited to fire when the animal is in a particular place in the environment, hence their name of place cell. What is very interesting about that system is that, unlike most of the hardwired systems that we are very familiar with, a cell is not dedicated to a particular point in space. When you place the mouse or the rat in a very different environment, the whole system remaps. So we have a completely stochastic allocation of particular cells to particular places in the environment. And what you see in CA3 is something, if we're looking here at the firing, for example, of a single place cell in CA3, as the animal is morphed from that square box into a circle, is a progressive transition that reflects, if you want, the behavioral transition. As the environment changes in very subtle ways, there is a progressive decrease in the firing of that place cell that is specific in that case for the upper left corner until it almost disappears in the circle. In contrast, when you look in the dentate gyrus, you have a situation that's very different. First of all, most of the place cells, and we'll come back to that, have multiple fields. So a given cell fires not just in one area, such as a CA3 or a CA1 cell, but in multiple areas in the field. But what's most remarkable is as we transition in these subtle behavioral transitions, all of a sudden there are remappings, which means that that cell that now fired with a particular pattern fires in a very different pattern at the next transition, and again with a very different pattern at the next transition. And it is believed that these remapping events that take place in the dentate gyrus, although the environment is changed in only a subtle way, is what allows for pattern separation. That's what allows basically the animal to distinguish that this box is different from this box, and eventually to map it into a coherent memory. So that's one of the ideas behind pattern separation, is that there is a computational process within the dentate gyrus that allows for discrimination between very similar situations. And I'll give you soon a behavioral example of that. So we decided to look at place cells in the dentate gyrus in different situations. So first I'm going to show you mature place cells in the dentate gyrus analyzed with calcium imaging. So for that, you basically simply inject in the dentate gyrus a virus carrying a calcium reporter, in that case GCAMP6F. And what that allows you to do, unlike the electrophysiological studies that were classically done, such as the one from the Moser, for example, before, it allows you to sample thousands of neurons at the same time as the animal performs various behavioral tasks. And these mini microscopes that were originally developed by Mark Schnitzer at Stanford are very light, so they are basically compatible with almost any behavioral situation. So, for example, the sorts of calcium activity you get is shown here. You basically have here a field of view, and you analyze basically for as long as you want. And the beauty also of that system is that you don't just have to analyze in one session. You can come the next day, a week later, a month later to the exact same location and see how the firing of these cells has changed across time, across learning paradigms. So I promised to Anna yesterday at dinner that I was going to show big data. So not only are we going to see big data, I'm saying big because basically from one mouse you have about a terabyte of information in just one session like that. So it really requires a type of analysis that classical biologists are not not comfortable with. So basically what we did is we teamed up with a team of computational neuroscientists that is led by Stefano Fusi at Columbia University. And basically what they do is they take the raw data. So this is basically the traces, the calcium traces deriving from the video I showed you earlier. And you can see that a particular cell fires every so often. And you have about thousands of these cells over about half an hour in the particular example that I'm going to show you here. And basically what they built is a linear decoder that correlates, if you want to put it in simple terms, the firing patterns of these thousand cells depending on what the position of the animal has on the x-axis and on the y-axis. And they do that on about half of the session. So they train the decoder, in that case a linear decoder, on about half of the session and assess then whether the decoder can predict the location of the animal on the other half of the session. So the first 15 minutes I used for training, the last 15 minutes I used for decoding. And basically, what you get when you do that is you get two positions, the mouse position, which is basically what just comes from the video, and the decoded position that comes from that linear decoder. And basically, to assess whether the decoder is capable of predicting, based on the firing pattern of all these thousand cells, the position of the animal, you basically assess how close the red dot is from the black dot. And in that case, I hope we're going to see an example. Oops. Still nothing. Okay. So the mouse position is in black. And here you see the decoder. Sometimes it does well. Here it does pretty well. So it tried to figure out when it does well and not when it does not well. There is a sort of pattern there that's emerging, sort of. Now we have an advantage. We look at that for hours at a time, so. So basically, when the animal is moving, the decoder does well. But when the animal is not moving, the decoder is all over the place. And that, I think, is very interesting because basically, you have patterns of neuronal activity when the animal is moving, which correlate with the position, and you have patterns of neuronal activity when the animal is immobile, which may represent what basically the mouse is thinking about when it is immobile. So the sorts of things you can do with such decoders is ask, is there a spatial pattern in the activity that is observed when the animal is immobile? And indeed, there is a spatial pattern of activity. Not only is there a spatial pattern of activity, but by and large, these are a bit preliminary, so I'm not going to show you the actual calculations, but by and large, it looks like when the animal is immobile, it's thinking about the future. So the pattern of activity that is represented, like for example in that case now, where it's all over the place, indicates where the animal is going to go next. Now, if you were in a much more complex environment, it would also be very interesting because now the animal wouldn't just thinking about where to go next, but maybe where food is. So these are the sorts of things you can ask, you can start asking with such big data sets. So I don't know if I've convinced you, Alain, but...
You did.
Thanks.
You did a good job.
So there is a use for mathematicians. So back to the place cells. So one thing that the dentagerus has, which is very different from the other structures of the hippocampus, is that there are these single-field place cells, but many multi-field place cells. About two-thirds of the cells are multi-field. And the attention has been, by classical electrophysiologists, mostly on single-field place cells, just because they are much easier to study. So what Stefano Fusi and his colleagues decided to do is to look at how much encoding, or decoding in that case, of position is allocated by the single field place cells or by the non-single field place cells. So what we're going to look at is basically three decoders. The The red one is the one that we saw before that uses all neurons. The green one is the one that uses only the single field neurons, and the blue one is the one that uses the multi-field neurons, basically all the other ones. You have a third of single field neurons and two-thirds of multi-field neurons. And then it's going to be a bit harder to figure out, but by and large, the answer to that is that it doesn't really make a big difference. So the animal is as good when using the multi-field cells as when using the single-field cells. There is actually no statistically significant difference. So what Stefano and colleagues did is to do another experiment where, again, in silico, you can manipulate the patterns of activity. So they decided to remove in single field cells, the main firing, for example, this is a place cell. Each dot corresponds to one calcium event. So in that case, you basically remove all the calcium events that are in the particular single field of that cell, and that's what you are left with. In that case, you are dealing with a multi-field cell, and you are removing the main peak. So you are removing that. And basically, you are now asking, how does the decoding work without the main field? And again, if place cells are that critical, you would think that decoding would drop dramatically. And basically what they find is that decoding is a little better. So this is the error rate, which is one way to assess how good the decoder does. Then when you remove in blue the main fields, but we are still far above chance. So even if you remove the main place fields from both the single field cells and the multi-field cells, we have a decoder that's still able to do very significantly better than chance. So that shows you that basically you have a much more complex pattern of encoding of spatial activity than what's provided by the place cells. You have a diffuse spatial organization of the information that's encoded by pretty much all the neurons that are present in the dentate gyrus. So let's move a bit to the behavioral equivalents of these sorts of computational approaches. So in human, to assess pattern separation, a classic task is to ask people to look at objects, long series of objects, with objects that are very different from one another, such as the duckling and the apple, objects that are identical, so every so often they see again the same duckling, but also situations where the object is similar, although different, like these two ducklings, or these two apples, or these two ropes. And basically what Craig Stark had observed when he analyzes pattern separation in people using such tasks is that when people have to discriminate between similar objects, such as the two ducklings, there is a preferential activation in the hippocampus, in the human hippocampus, as measured by fMRI, in the regions containing the dentate gyrus. They don't quite have dentate gyrus resolution, but pretty much the area containing CA3 and the dentate gyrus is more active when there is the need to discriminate between similar observations. Another thing that Craig Stark observed, which is very interesting, and we'll come back to that toward the end, is that that capacity decreases with age dramatically, that ability to distinguish between similar objects, and also decreases in various anxiety disorders, PTSD, panic disorders most notably. So what we decided to do is to basically do something similar in mice and assess whether mice can discriminate in that case, not between similar objects, but between similar contexts. So we did a variation of contextual fear conditioning. You may know that contextual fear conditioning is a design where you basically place the mice in an arena, a particular context, let's call it context A, give them a food shock, and the next day place them either in the same box or in a very different box. And if the animal has learned how to associate the box or the context with the food shock, it will freeze in context A, but not freeze in a very different context called context B. And that's a task that's very sensitive to both hippocampal manipulations and amygdala manipulations from the work of Joe Ledoux, Mike Fanzolo, Mike Davis, and a few others. So when you have a task like that, which is called contextual fear learning, whether an animal has neurogenesis in the hippocampus, no neurogenesis in the hippocampus, or more neurogenesis in the hippocampus really doesn't make a difference. However, where you start seeing differences in animals that have more or less levels of neurogenesis is when you make the task more difficult. And to make the task more difficult, you basically make B context B much more similar to A. So instead of changing all the cues, you change just one cue, such as just the smell, or just the color of the walls, or just the shape of the box. And in these situations, the task becomes very sensitive to neurogenesis. So just to give you an example, in that case, we are looking at mice that don't have neurogenesis as a result of irradiation. That's an experiment that was performed by Amar Sahai when he was a postdoc in the lab. And here you're looking at the control mice, and basically what you see is that, let me just run you very briefly through the behavioral protocol. On every day, they get a food shock in A. 3 hours later, they are exposed to B, where they don't get a food shock, and that's repeated over several days. So initially, what we are looking at here is freezing, which is the way the mouse displays its fear. The more they freeze, the more they remember, basically, that the context is dangerous. At the beginning, they generalize. They are not capable of separating A and B, but then progressively, freezing in B, shown in red, decreases, while freezing in A stays constant over days because they basically get reminded every day that A is dangerous because they get a shock in A every day. If you do that same paradigm in animals that don't have neurogenesis, in 5 days they are basically not capable of separating A from B. It takes them about twice longer. You have to wait about 10 days for them to start discriminating between A and B. More recently, we have also repeated that with an optogenetic design. That's an experiment that was done by Mason Kirbeck when he was a postdoc in the lab. And what Mason did basically is to express, in that case, arch rhodopsin in the young neurons, as shown here, or in mature neurons. And for that, he used an ARC conditional mouse that basically allows you to label with that inhibitory opsin a similar number of mature neurons as what you can label. So that's as a control experiment. So let's look first at what happens when you silence the young neurons in a pattern separation task with ARCH. So basically the paradigm is similar, that they get exposed every day to the sequence of AB context, where they get a context every day in a foot shock every day in A, but nothing in B, and the light is shone when they are in the ambiguous context, which is context B, which means that each time they hit context B, which is the ambiguous one, the young neurons are silenced with ARCH. And basically what you have in the control is a very robust pattern separation, such as like in the previous experiment, where in that case we have freezing in red in A that stays constant or reaches a plateau, while freezing in B decreases. And when you do that in the mice that carry the nesting arch construct, you basically prevent, in that case, for as long as you do the test, pattern separation. So each time, so they're basically incapable in that case, even over 9 days, but we have now gone up to about 15 days, and they are still not capable of doing pattern separation when the young neurons are not active in the ambiguous context. Yeah, in that case, you're right, both actually go down. So there is a confusion, probably, which is that if it had just been a deficit in pattern separation, you would have had the blue curve reach the red curve. Here we are seeing actually a confusion because now when they are in A, they are not completely sure in what context they are. So they are basically confused, or that's in our interpretation, between A and B. So freezing actually goes down in both. When you do the same thing as a control, when inhibiting the young neurons, sorry, the mature neurons, so that's the arc-inducible construct, where you have a similar number of mature neurons now carrying the inhibitory opsin, you basically don't have an impairment in pattern separation. You have actually a slight improvement in pattern separation, which we don't really have an explanation for, but certainly no impairment such as in the young neuron inhibition case. So that's sort of some behavioral evidence that for a paradigm that's possibly related to pattern separation, that contextual discrimination learning, young neurons are necessary. So what we have been asking next is what's happening in the dentate gyrus when animals have to do such a separation between similar contexts. And for that, we had to use a different technology because in the previous technology, the mini microscope, you have only one color. So you can either image the mature cells or the young cells. But in that case, we wanted to actually compare activity of the mature cells and the young cells in the same preparation. So for that, we used the two-photon prep, such as the one that Sebastian described yesterday, where basically the animal is in a head-fixed prep, navigating on a treadmill. Again, G-CAMP is injected in the dentate gyrus to label all the cells of the dentate gyrus and to allow for calcium imaging. And we have a marker, a conditional marker for the young neurons in red. So what we're going to look at here is activity of place cells, both young place cells and mature place cells in the dentate gyrus as the animal does several rotations on the track. So the track is organized in a spatial way because there are different cues on the treadmill, on the walls, and different sounds and smells that come up at different positions of the treadmill. So that's to create a virtual or artificial context. So basically, the way this is represented now is here, the mouse is moving on that treadmill. The blue bar is the position of the mouse. Each time it does a turn corresponds to one turn of the mouse on the treadmill. And here we're imaging two cells. The ones we selected in that case are two place cells, two single peak place cells. The green one is a mature one, and the red one is a young one. Young in that case, because of the conditional expression of TD tomato in the 4 to 6 week critical period that I defined earlier. So we're basically going to compare the firing of these cells, of these two cells, as the animal navigates on that treadmill. So this is the calcium transients that correspond basically to the quantification of the video. So this green transient corresponds to the mature cell, and this red transient corresponds to a young neuron, a 4 to 6 week old young neuron. So this is voluntary running, so sometimes the mouse runs fast, sometimes it stops. But you can clearly see sort of that we're dealing with two place cells, two actually single peak place cells in that case, because the red one really fires only in that part of the treadmill, and the green one fires only in that part. So in that case, we haven't selected multi-field place cells, such as the one I showed you in the open field earlier, because it's just easier for visualization when you're dealing with just one area of the field where the cell fires. So when you compare the firing actually of these two cells, you start noticing some differences. Even though they both have place cells properties, you can see that this one actually fires more often than this one. It's slightly more active and slightly more promiscuous. So that's something that we have quantified. This is the activity of the cells, so the young cells, confirming earlier electrophysiological work, are more active than the mature cells. This is just global activity. And this is tuning specificity, which is one way to evaluate how precise the place fields are on that treadmill. So this is done with a slightly different computation than the one that is used for place field analysis when you are in a circular or square arena. And basically what you can see is that the young cells, the red ones, have less tuning specificity. They are less spatially tuned than the mature cells. So that is an interesting property. It's not exactly the one we would have predicted. We would have actually predicted the opposite, because if the young neurons are good for pattern separation, we would have actually thought that the young neurons may have had more tuning specificity to allow them for finer discrimination. Here, what you are seeing is basically a situation where these young neurons are less spatially tuned. So the next thing we ask that relates more directly to pattern separation is what happens to the firing of these cells when you shift the environment. So now it's more like a Moser-type experiment where you switch from one context to another one. And for that, you basically just replace the treadmill by a different one, one that has different texture on its floor, as well as different cues on the walls surrounding the treadmill. So it's a remapping experiment, basically. And the way it's done is you place animals in context A, which is one of the treadmill, and then you have a lag period, place them in context B, a lag period, and place them again in context B. And you're basically looking at the similarity of the tuning curves of these placed cells, whether they go back from B to B or whether they go from B to A. And that's what's sort of shown in a visual way here. So here the place fields have been organized in terms of position on the treadmill. So on the left, you have the place cells that are on the beginning of the treadmill, and on the right, you have the place cells that are at the end of the treadmill. And basically what you can see very nicely is that the whole treadmill, the whole length of the treadmill is covered by these place cells. And if you analyze the pattern now, when you go from B to B, you may notice that there is more resemblance sort of between this pattern and this one than between this pattern and this one, and that's what's quantified here. However, there is still very important remapping, and that was a bit of a surprise also. We were predicting that when animals are on one treadmill and move to a very similar one, the patterns of activity are going to be much more similar, which would have shown up here as a very clear diagonal like this one. But there is actually quite a bit of remapping. So what that made us realize sort of is that we are actually in a very different behavioral situation than the one in which we actually evaluated pattern separation. In the pattern separation, the mouse is shocked in one context and not shocked in the other one. So that's much more salient than just navigating to neutral treadmills. So basically what you're gonna have to do is redo these remapping experiments in a situation now where there is either positive or negative valence. And we don't have the answer to that because these are actually difficult to do as the animal is on a treadmill. Because if you have a negative valence, the animal freezes, stops moving, and you can't see any place cells anymore. So there is actually a few tricks there that have to be implemented. Maybe positive valence actually is going to be more useful to actually look at behavioral pattern separation and the ability of the cells to remap. However, what's already interesting is that with that sort of neutral, if you want, pattern separation task, there is really not much difference between the remapping of the young neurons in red and the remapping of the green neurons, the mature ones. And that's also a surprise because we would have predicted that to allow for better pattern separation, the young neurons are going to remap more than the mature ones. Doesn't seem to be the case. So that's sort of leading us to a hypothesis that we are currently developing, which is that, so this is basically just recapitulating the points I was making here, but the hypothesis that we're currently working on is that the young neurons may not encode information in the same way as the mature neurons do. What they may simply do is modulate the activity of the mature cells. So we have the beginning of some evidence for that. I'm just going to present you here very preliminary data where you basically stimulate the entorhinal cortex that innervates the dentate gyrus and record from mature cells of the dentate gyrus either in baseline conditions or in conditions where with arch you are inhibiting the young neurons. So this is the patterns of activity that you see in mature cells after stimulation of the input fibers, and that's what you see when you are doing the same thing while silencing the young neurons. And what you're basically seeing here is an increase in the activity of that mature cell when the young neurons are silenced with ARCH. If you superpose the two, it's a bit easier to see. So what that suggests is that the net effect of the young neurons may actually be an inhibitory effect on the mature cells. This is summarized in the following cartoon. So what we are doing in that experiment is stimulating the perforon path and recording from a mature cell, and you get a particular level of output, and that level of output increases when you silence the young neurons, suggesting that the net effect of the young neurons is to inhibit the mature cells. And since the young neuron does not communicate directly with the mature cell, it's likely via an inhibitory interneuron. And we have not yet characterized which type of inhibitory interneuron is responsible for that, if you want, lateral-like inhibition. So that concludes sort of the cognitive part of the presentation. So in the last 10 minutes, I'm just going to briefly go through the more mood-related part. So what we have shown at that point is that young neurons are indeed active in pattern separation situations. They participate in pattern separation, and it's possible, based on that preliminary electrophysiological work, that the way they participate in pattern separation is by modulating, by inhibiting the activity of the mature cells that surround them. So how can we think now of a very different function of the dentate gyrus and of neurogenesis within the dentate gyrus, not anymore in the learning and memory domain, but in the anxiety and depression domain? So there are two sort of vignettes I'd like to point you to maybe start to think of a framework for how the processes that I have been talking about, particularly the pattern separation process, may not just impact cognition, but may also impact mood. So one is a sort of an intuitive example. Let's imagine you walk in a park. There is no danger in that park. And all of a sudden, you hear a loud noise. If you are a war veteran, that loud noise, by a process of pattern completion or generalization, may bring you back to a combat situation in which you hear the loud noise and experience the severe trauma. However, very rapidly, when you are in that situation, by a process akin to pattern separation, you basically separate the present and the past, and you realize that you're in a safe situation and that there is no reason to be afraid. However, if as a result of that traumatic episode you developed an anxiety disorder, such as post-traumatic stress disorder, you may not be able to perform that pattern separation, and you may continuously generalize and display a strong panic attack, even though you're in a safe environment. So this is a sort of hypothesis that can be tested in human, and that's work that's in progress to basically assess whether people with various anxiety disorders, such as post-traumatic disorders, have indeed deficits in pattern separation. But it's also something that starts to give you maybe an indication for how that cognitive process of pattern separation could impact not just our ability to learn new information, but also to separate safe from dangerous, and that has implication for anxiety disorders, because in anxiety disorders, and to some degree in depression also, there is overgeneralization. People tend to consider too many situations as dangerous or anxiety-provoking, even when there is no obvious threat in the environment, but simply because it reminds them of something threatful. Another framework which I think is useful in terms of thinking of the dual function of the hippocampus is the differentiation along the dorsoventral axis. And I don't have time to summarize all the data, but there is lesion studies, anatomical studies, physiological studies, and gene expression studies now from many groups that have clearly shown very different functions for the dorsal and the ventral hippocampus, not just at the level of the dentate gyrus, but at the level of the three fields, dentate, CA3, and CA1. Just going to show you the anatomical connections, because I think these are in many ways the most clear case for a very different function of these two regions. And it's not so much at the level of the input. The input comes from the entorhinal context, whether you're looking at the dorsal hippocampus or the ventral hippocampus. But when you look at the output, so this is the banana-shaped hippocampus in a rodent, with this being the dorsal part and this being the ventral part. In humans, it's obviously tilted, so we are dealing more with anterior-posterior. But the dorsal part of the hippocampus projects primarily to association cortices. And that's probably where its cognitive function comes into place. The ventral hippocampus, in contrast, projects to basically the whole limbic system. The amygdala, the medial prefrontal cortex, the bed nucleus, the hypothalamus, the ventral striatum. So the idea, while the dorsal hippocampus does not project to the limbic system. So the idea is that if that process of pattern separation and pattern completion takes place in the trisynaptic circuit equally well on the dorsoventral side. It's more where that information is sent that is very different. Here it's sent into association cortices for long-term storage of memories. Here it's sent to the limbic system to acquire valence, so possibly to the ventral striatum to acquire positive valence, to the amygdala maybe to acquire negative valence. At least that's a framework. So we've started to manipulate neurogenesis within that framework. So neurogenesis takes place both dorsally and ventrally. That's a sagittal section where you can see both simultaneously the dorsal dentate and the ventral dentate, and you're again seeing these young neurons labeled by tau EGFP in the POMC promoter, both dorsally and ventrally. And what you can do with irradiation is either get rid of all the neurogenesis in dorsal and ventral poles, or with more selected irradiation, get rid of them just dorsally or just ventrally. So when you get rid of them everywhere, this is work that was done now more than 10 years ago by Luca Santarelli when he was a postdoc in the lab. When you get rid of all of neurogenesis, you basically lose the effects of antidepressants in a number of paradigms, such as the novelty suppressed feeding and the chronic unpredictable stress. So what we decided to look at, since here we are looking at an effect that's much more in the mood and anxiety domain, where is that effect? Is it dorsal or ventral? So more recently, Melody Wu in the lab devised a lead shield that allows basically her to irradiate either just dorsally or just ventrally, and repeated the classic antidepressant experiment, and basically was able to show that while whole irradiation prevented, as in the previous slide, the effect in that case of fluoxetine in the novelty suppressed feeding, dorsal irradiation had little effect, while ventral irradiation had an effect that was almost as robust as total irradiation. So that's the beginning of an indication that indeed that more mood-related function of neurogenesis is primarily coming from the ventral pole. So having said that neurogenesis can modulate mood and cognition leads to sort of, can we actually harness that process to improve mood and cognition? And you heard in the previous presentation about the plethora of transcription factors, markers that basically characterize the various stages of the neurogenic process. So we have manipulated not all of these factors, but just a few to basically gain genetic, if you want, proof of principle that if we increase neurogenesis, can we improve cognition and mood? So what we targeted is actually the cell death pathway and the fact that, as I mentioned in the introduction, in baseline conditions, about 80% of the young neurons die of apoptotic cell death. And that's a process that is mediated by genes such as BAX, BAC, BCL, and a few others. So what Amar Sahai did when he was in the lab, when he was a postdoc in the lab, was delete the BAX gene, that pro-apoptotic BAX gene, from the stem cells and their progeny, using a nesting Cre-ER inducible strategy, and was able that way to prevent basically cell death of the young neurons. And now instead of having 80% of these young neurons die within a month, almost all of them survived. So you have four to five-fold increase in neurogenesis by very specifically manipulating these stem cells and their progeny. And then these animals, these IBAX mice, as we call them, were tested in both cognitive and mood-related tasks. So in pattern separation, as predicted, we got an improvement in pattern separation. So this is a control experiment where the mice take about 9 days to start performing pattern separation, while the BAX mice that have four to five times more neurogenesis do it quite a bit faster. You started having a significant separation by about 5 days. So this is for the cognitive domain. For the mood domain, the situation is a little bit different. In baseline conditions, no effect of the BAX manipulation on anxiety or depression-related measures. However, if you pre-stress the animals, if you basically make them depressed, in that case with a chronic corticosterone paradigm, now you can start seeing effects of that BAX manipulation. So here we're looking at an anxiety-related test, which is the elevated plasmase. Here we are looking at more of a depression-related task, such as the tail suspension test. And in both of these tests, you can see that the Bax manipulation can reverse the deficit elicited by that depressogenic, if you want, chronic corticosterone paradigm. So evidence that we may be able, by just targeting, and in that case I say just because that manipulation really only targets the neurogenesis process, nothing else in the rest of the animal. The difficulty, obviously, to move that to a more translational domain is that when you start using systemic agents, such as, for example, Bax antagonists, you are now infusing these systemically and looking at effects that may be mediated by neurogenesis, but may also be mediated by the many other targets that Bax has in the whole organism. So again, just for proof of principle, we have started to look at Bax antagonists, and indeed we can find improvements in pattern separation. In that case, it's one of these Bax antagonists called IMAC2, and you can see a robust increase in pattern separation in these treated animals compared to the controls. Now, what we don't know yet, and that still remains to be done, is that neurogenesis dependent. So the way to do that is to basically do the same experiments in animals that don't have neurogenesis and ask in these animals, can we also get that improvement in pattern separation? Now, you can also use environmental manipulations, and one of the most robust environmental manipulation to stimulate neurogenesis is exercise. So for that, what we did is actually test old animals. So old animals, very similar to old humans. I mentioned that in the fMRI study from Craig Stark, he had shown big deficits in pattern separation for that novel object recognition task. In aging, well, in mice, it's exactly the same. When you're comparing young animals here, they do much better than old animals. Now, if you present these old animals with a one-month-long running regimen on a treadmill, you improve pattern separation quite significantly, not quite at the level of the young ones, and that is accompanied, as has been shown by many authors, by a robust stimulation of neurogenesis. Now, what we have not shown, just like in the case of the Bax inhibitor experiment, is it neurogenesis dependent? And to do that, you basically need to do, again, the same experiment in animals that don't have neurogenesis and see whether that effect of exercise is gone. So I'm just going to, maybe 2 minutes to wrap it up. Yeah, okay. So from a translational point of view, what you are trying to do basically is utilize neurogenesis to stratify anxiety and depression-related disorders. So the idea is to take patients who have various symptoms of anxiety or depression-related symptoms and basically use assays of pattern separation to try to evaluate how good their neurogenesis is and basically select, based on these psychological pattern separation tasks, those that have impairments. And these will be candidates for therapies that are aimed at stimulating neurogenesis. Therapies that can be either pharmacological or environmental in the case of exercise. So for that, you need to actually prove that people who have anxiety disorders or depression-related disorders have deficits in pattern separation. So we've been developing a number of tasks that are basically inspired by the mice tasks. So just like in mice, we do contextual discrimination learning. In people, we can design virtual reality settings where in one of the settings, as you navigate it with a virtual reality goggle and a joystick, in one of the settings, you get a finger shock, which is the equivalent of the mouse foot shock, and in the other one, you don't. And basically ask how well people do in a pattern separation where you have, for example, to distinguish between that maze characterized by a series of rooms, such as this one versus this one. And these are experiments that are in progress. There is some preliminary evidence that indeed people with anxiety disorders have deficits in such pattern separation tasks. So then the question is, can one use that to stratify the disorder and then to treat the disorder? So just to conclude, why neurogenesis? Well, I told you quite a bit about pattern separation. This seems to be a function. You heard also from Pierre-Marie yesterday that in the olfactory system, it actually may also have a pattern separation related function, because he was using an odorant discrimination task to basically emphasize the function of these young neurons. And maybe that need for variable levels of pattern separations depending on environmental situations has to do with the fact that when you are in an enriched situation, there is much more need, the cognitive demand is much bigger, and there is a bigger need for pattern separation. While you're in a stressful situation, there is less of a need. So you can think of it a bit like a seasonal type variation, where, let's say, in the summer, there is plenty of food and environments to explore, you need more neurogenesis. In the winter, which is a more stressful situation where there is less need to explore and more need to hide, maybe less need for neurogenesis. So that's maybe one of the ways to think of a biological function in a more ethological setting. How can it improve mood and cognition? Well, for that, I think the framework is that even though pattern separation is done both dorsally and ventrally, it is really the consequence of that pattern separation that is going to be very different whether you are dealing with the dorsal part of the hippocampus and the ventral part of the hippocampus. And the people who have done that work are shown here. The physiology is primarily Victor Luna and a postdoc who was in the lab, Liam Drew, who is now back in England. Much of the behavior has been done by Lindsay, Jessica, for much of the optogenetic work. Jessica is an MD-PhD student who started working with Mason Kirbeck when he was a postdoc in the lab and has carried basically most of the optogenetic and calcium imaging data I presented. And some of the behavioral studies are now ongoing with Chris Anaker, Kate Notial, and Elena Carazzo. And there's a few collaborators, some of whom are in the audience, like Denis David and Indira David, and also the computational group led by Fabio, led by Stefano Fusi, with Fabio Stefanini, a postdoc, and Ludmila Kushnir, a PhD student. Thank you.